The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold.
Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery.
This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our various programs, please visit us online at zmm.org.
Thanks for listening.
This is from the Book of Serenity, Case 13, Linji's Blind Ass, the pointer. Devoted entirely to helping others, you don't know there is self. You should exert the law to the fullest without concern that there be no people. For this, it is necessary to have the ruthless ability to snap a wooden pillar in two. When about to go, what then? The main case. When Master Linji was about to die, he admonished Sanxing. After I pass on, don't destroy my treasury of the Eye of Truth. Sanxing said, how dare I destroy the teacher's treasury of the Eye of Truth? Linji said, if someone suddenly questions you about it, how will you reply? Sanxing immediately shouted. Linji said, who would have known that my treasury of the Eye of Truth would perish in this blind ass? The verse. The robe of faith is imparted at midnight to Huanung, stirring up the 700 monastics at Huangmei. The Eye of Truth of the branch of Linji, the blind ass destroying it, gets the hatred of others. Mind to mind, they seal each other. Ancestor to ancestor, they pass on the lamp. Leveling oceans and mountains, magically producing a rock. Just the name and word is hard to compare. In sum, the method is knowing how to fly. Good morning. So yesterday, Elizabeth Morrison, a scholar from Middlebury College who specializes in the history of Chinese Buddhism, Chan specifically, was here, and she had to go home to be with her family. I had prepared this koan in part for her. So she told me that she mostly has studied the teachings of Lingji. And in just listening to her speak yesterday and the conversations that we had and the questions that were raised, you know, it really made me think, and we had a couple of our own conversations, she and I, just about how this Dharma path has come down to us and the many, many periods and times of evolution of traveling from one country to another culture, to another language, to another worldview, and how it, because it's not dogmatic or doctrinal, how it became assimilated into each new culture and people and language, and how in that way Buddhism had the opportunity to be absorbed and practiced and become a liberating path within that country, and also how it was affected, how it was influenced. Right? Because Buddhism is a living thing, and so how it, in its livingness, in living in the, not just in the sutras, but in the bodies and minds and decisions and communities of practitioners, how it has been changed over the years. Not the heart of it, we have faith, but the expressions of it, and how that ongoing dynamic of having reverence for and respect for a tradition, this vehicle, this vessel that has come down to us, it gives us a way of practicing together, and also that it can evolve and change to the times and places and how those work together. And the pointer says, devoted entirely to helping others, you don't know that there is self. And really we are in a tradition that of a long, continuous stream of practitioners who have been devoted to liberating the bodies and minds of themselves and of others, because it arises together, as we see it in the Bodhisattva path. And also, this really began with the Buddha. You know, the Buddha, after his enlightenment, remember, he seriously contemplated not teaching. And so what would have happened? We don't know, but we wouldn't be here to think about it, right? We wouldn't even know that he had made that choice. But instead, he devoted the rest of his life. In fact, I remember one ancient teacher saying that even though he had given up his practice with those ascetics before his enlightenment, he lived an ascetic life, and that asceticism was to always be living within community. That rigor, that demand. And he chose that. And he kept choosing that throughout the whole of his life. He didn't have to do that. I remember sometimes in the early years when things would be going well, or my teacher would be not entirely happy with how things were going, or maybe some of us, and he would say, you know, I don't have to do this. He said, I did my training. I could do something else, you know, as a way of saying, you know, do you want to do this, right? I was reading, somebody sent me an op-ed by David Brooks, who writes a lot for the Times and books, and he said, one of the unsettling findings of modern psychology is that we often don't know why we do what we do. You can ask somebody, why'd you choose that house? Why'd you marry that person? Why'd you go to graduate school? And people will come up with some plausible story, but often they really have no idea why they choose what they do. We have a conscious self, of course, the voice in our minds, but this conscious self has, we know what we're feeling, just not how and why we got there. But we also don't want to admit how little we know about ourselves, so we make up some story or confabulation. Well, we are here to change that. We are here to know, to be much more clear about why we are here, about why we are doing what we're doing, about what we're feeling. He says, we know what we're feeling. I think he's being quite generous there. I think oftentimes we exactly do not know what we're feeling. Not really. We have a sense of something that's happening in here, out there, somewhere. We may know that we're angry, but we're not really knowing our anger. Not in the way that we do with mindfulness, with self-awareness, with courage, with practice. How clearly can we know a thought, an emotion, a desire, an intention? We should want to know. We should want to find out, how clearly can I know myself, my mind, my karma? Dogen said, to study the way is to study the self. And in studying the self, we come to the many, many moments of forgetting the self, liberating the self, enlightening the self by the 10,000 things. And that is to free the bodies and minds of self and other. And so being devoted entirely to helping others, the Bodhisattva path, is to be devoted to the practice and the realization of selfless wisdom, selfless compassion, and in arriving at the place where we don't know there is self. You know, all along, the sense of self is a little bit necessary. It's a little bit necessary to have someone who experiences pain and suffering, who experiences loss and grief, who also sees that there's happiness and joy and is trying to sort that out. We need some sense of self to help raise bodhicitta. It's helpful. Right? We don't always use it helpfully, that's for sure. But a little bit of sense of self is helpful and continues to be. And in a sense, in practice, we learn how to recognize that sense of self arising in a way that is increasingly constructive and helpful and liberative, to the point of releasing that sense of self altogether, which is nothing more ever than a sense of something. It's like a scent that passes by, but you can't hold on to it. And then he says, we should exert the law to the fullest without concern that there be no people. It's interesting, these two lines. And why, you know, I often really look at, you know, the teachings, or particularly with the koans, it's like, particularly with the commentaries, because the koans often are, in a sense, reports of a recorded conversation, right, as this one is. But then the pointer, the verse, the commentary is really what the teacher, that teacher chose to focus, to bring our attention to. Why this? And why were they inspired by this particular koan to speak about this particular point? Sometimes it's very obvious. It's just really directly pointing to the koan and the point of it, the dharma of it. But sometimes they're bringing other points out, right? And so here, this koan is really Lin Ji, this great sort of luminary within the Zen tradition, very dynamic teacher, who's dying. He's on his deathbed. And he summoned his sangha together and the head monk and his chief disciple, San Sheng. He had two other disciples as well. And he's asking this really important question, which he already knows the answer to, and San Sheng also knows the answer to. But why waste this moment? And look at it again. And so in our practice, we take a vow to help others, to dedicate ourselves to helping others and realizing selflessness, so we can do that more and more truly compassionately, to share this dharma, to reveal the path. So in the example of the Buddha, and there is also a commitment to maintaining the integrity of the dharma, recognizing how everything that appears is in a state of decay, right? Is in a state of dissolution, of disappearing, of dissolving, because it's impermanent. I remember years ago, I had injured my knee running, and I called Hogan, who was a physician, and I told him what was happening. I said, "What do you think? What's going on?" He goes, "You're basically entering into a state of ongoing decay and dissolution." I said, "Thanks for that. Anything more you can say while I'm still here?" A commitment to maintaining the integrity, which really means the full power of this dharma. To not cut it off, or to cut it off in pieces. And that takes ongoing effort, because this dharma path is a long and demanding path. Right? It's not something that is easily accessed, easily obtained. It's not even easy to get to. And certainly in our time, we're taught that things should be easy. We shouldn't have to work too hard, that if we're working too hard, something's wrong. And of course, we can work hard in ways that are not helpful. And because there's an inclination for something that first comes to life and is vital and vibrant to be made easier and easier and more accessible, and that's one of the things that historically happens in the dissemination of a tradition, as it reaches out and tries to reach more and more people. It, in a sense, has to become easier. It has to be able to be absorbed in people's lives, which can be very demanding, very full, very busy. The Buddha recognized that. And so that dynamic, that tension, that balance of reaching out and of bringing the dharma to anyone, everyone who is drawn to it, and making it something that they can actually practice, and at the same time maintaining that full strength of the teachings of the practice. That is what has been, always been one of the roles of a monastery, in I think all traditions. And for a teacher like Lin Ji to be able to teach all beings, to be able to appear like Kanon Bodhisattva in all kinds of forms, sometimes very gentle, like a summer breeze, and other, sometimes very, very fierce or demanding, being able to snap a wooden pillar in two, and Lin Ji was known for that. It was very interesting, his the story of how he came to the Dharma. He came to Huang Po, who was a great, very well-known teacher, and this is fairly early, 9th century, early 9th century China. And he came to Huang Po, who was this very, very dynamic, powerful teacher. And he studied with Huang Po at Huang Po's monastery for 3 years. And one day, the head monk, Muzhou, asked Lin Jun, he said, how long have you been practicing here? And he was also said to have been a really exemplary monastic, was really a very sincere practitioner. And Muzhou said, how long have you been here? And Lin Jun said, 3 years. And Muzhou said, have you ever gone in to see the teacher, right, for direct teaching? And Lin Jun says, I haven't. I don't know what to say. I don't know what to ask him. And Muzhou says, well, why don't you ask him what is the essential meaning of Buddhism? And so, which is a valid question. It's a question that's been asked many times. And so Lin Jun went to see Wang Bo, but before he could even ask the question, Wang Bo struck him with his staff, drove him out. And so Muzhou saw him and said, well, what happened? And he says, well, when I tried to get the words out, he hit me. I don't understand. And Muzhou said, well, go ask him again. And so he went to ask him again. Same thing happened. And then he tried a third time at the urging of Muzhou. Third time he was struck and driven out. So Lin Jun came to Muzhou, the head monk, and said, you know, before you asked me to go to Huang Po, the great master, and ask him, but all he's done is struck me, won't even let me talk. I must have some very difficult past karma that is not allowing me to see his essential teaching. So I'm leaving. And Muzhou said, okay, but if you're going to leave, you have to go take leave of the teacher, which is, the right thing to do. It's a courtesy. And so Muzhou went to Huang Po before Lin Jun got to him and said, look, that monk that's coming asking questions, he's young, but he's actually quite special. There's something special about this person. If he comes to say goodbye, please give him some appropriate instruction. And this is very, this is sort of what happens. Who knows what Wang Po's experience of this monk was. Maybe he saw something in him that was, in Lin Jun, that was causing him to respond this way. Maybe it was that he felt like he did have a lot of potential. Maybe he thought that he was really arrogant and was trying to take some of that off. But Muzhou, who was probably more in contact with Lin Jun and was seeing him more, had a different perspective and brought that to Wang Po. And that's what seniors do, right? That there's a dynamic that goes back and forth. And so when Lin Jun came to him to bow and take his leave, Wang Po said, you don't need to go somewhere far. He said, just go over to this other monastery and practice with Master Dai Yu. He'll explain it to you. So Lin Jun went to Master Dai Yu. Dai Yu said, where have you come from? And he told him the whole story. And Dai Yu said, Huang Po has old grandmotherly affection and endures all of this difficulty that you've given to him for your sake. And here you are asking whether you've made some error or not. Because Lin Jun says, I don't understand what I'm doing wrong. Huang Po is doing all of this for you, and all you can think of is where your fault is. And upon hearing those words, it said that Lin Jun was awakened. And then Lin Jun said, actually, Huang Po's dharma isn't that special. So Dai Yu grabbed him and said, you little bedwetter. You just came here and said you don't understand. Now you say that there's nothing to Huang Po's teaching. What do you see? Speak. And Lin Jun hit him 3 times. And Wang Bo let him go and says, your teacher is Huang Po. I got nothing to do with this. And sent him back to Huang Po. And when he came to Huang Po, Huang Po said, this fellow keeps coming and going. When is it ever going to stop? And Lin Jun said, only through your great compassion. Lin Jun bowed and stood in front of him. Huang Po says, who has gone and returned? What have you seen? And Lin Jun said, yesterday I received the master's compassionate instruction. Today I went and practiced at Dai Yu's place. Wang Po said, what did Dai Yu say? Lin Jun said, told him the story. And Wang Po said, that old that old man, Dayu, talks too much. Next time I see him, I'll give him a painful swat. And Linji says, why wait until later? Here's a swat right here, and struck him 3 times. And Wangpo yelled out and said, this crazy fellow's come here and grabbed the tiger's whiskers. And then he called out to the attendant and said, take this guy away and give him a seat in the meditation hall. And one of the things I find so interesting about that story is that Linji went on to be this really very great master and very well-known and had many, many students and was very bold, very dynamic. And here we see both of those aspects, right? We see this sort of timid, shy, insecure, not knowing what to ask, not knowing what my fault is. And then we see in the next moment, this arrogance coming out, right? And confidence at the same time. And it often goes like that. You know, sometimes the people who start off the quietest and the most timid, I think, we're just waiting for that to change. And when it does, there's going to be some roaring going on. And so Linji says, ask San Sheng, after I pass on, don't destroy my treasury of the Eye of Truth, my Shobo Genzo, the eye of the true Dharma, that which is realized, that is unborn, undying, uncreated, unextinguished, that is liberation itself. There is the teaching, there is training, there is bringing and gathering people together as a Sangha and practicing together. There is training and transmitting the Dharma for the next generation. That's what happens every day. Raising bodhicitta. Reflecting, practicing, realizing, integrating. And in that transmission, the Dharma of the Dharma, the disciple takes a vow, right, to continue the lineage, to keep that vessel afloat and moving across the stream. To hold the essence, to bring it to life, so that others can enter these gates to liberate suffering, to bring forth compassion. And that is a great gift and a great responsibility that is handed down. It doesn't always happen, of course. If you look at the lineages of teachers going back all the way through China. In our tradition, you see lineages that keep continuing and those that don't. They just end. Sometimes a teacher doesn't teach. Somebody finishes their training and they just disappear. Sometimes they teach and have no successors. Sometimes their successors have no successors. This is all just part of it. So when he says, you should exert the law to the fullest without concern that there be no people, I hear that as transmit the full Dharma, hold nothing back. The Buddha said, you know, when he was dying in the Mahapara Nirvana Sutra, Ananda's sort of wailing and saying, you're leaving, but you should teach us, you should stay and teach us. And Ananda and Shakyamuni says, what do you want from me? He said, I've been teaching all of these years, I have held nothing back. I have held nothing back. And so when Linji says, don't destroy my treasure of the true eye of the Dharma, and San Sheng says, how dare I destroy this? In the commentary it says, in reality, this thing does not increase, even though 1,000 Buddhas appear in the world, this treasury of the true Dharma, nor does it decrease when 1,000 sages pass away. When it is transmitted to the next generation, it is not increasing. When it is not transmitted, or a line dies out, it is not decreasing. Then it says, how could one San Sheng be able to cause it to prosper or die out? The Dharma, the teachings, the practices that are handed down, the possibility of training, sanghas, monasteries, gatherings, that needs to be kept alive. That lives and dies. But this that cannot be destroyed is not of the common world. It is not one hair apart, and it is not one hair apart from our everyday lives. In the world of things that we see and measure and compare and possess and buy and sell, right? That's the world of our struggles and concerns and anxieties. And that's why in that world, when we don't have something to buy and sell, when we don't have something to love and hate, we feel bereft. When we gain something, then we have to guard it because we might lose it. Somebody might take it away. And so the Buddha said, all conditioned things are dukkha. All conditioned things hold the potential for us to use that to create our misery, our unhappiness, our confusion, our conflict. And all of those seeds, all of those possibilities are within us. And so the question then becomes, is there anything that can bring true contentment that cannot be lost? That was the Buddha's search. He understood that true liberation has to be something that cannot be lost, which has to mean it cannot be given. What is that? And so here we speak of it as the treasury of the eye of truth, Shobogenso. Because there is no house that once built will not eventually fall apart, even this great and noble house. I am so glad I won't be here to watch it fall apart. What will that even look like? But it's the nature of things, right? The Buddha himself said, I wandered through the rounds of countless births, seeking but not finding the builder of this house. This house. And then he said, sorrowful indeed is birth, again and again, building that house again, having to guard it, having to protect it, losing it again, building it again. And then he said, oh, house builder, you have now been seen through. You shall build this house no more. All of your rafters have been broken, your ridgepole shattered. My mind has attained to unconditional freedom. Achieved is the end of my craving. So San Ching said, how dare I destroy the teacher's treasury of the eye of truth? And he's not playing with words. Even if he tried, he couldn't destroy it. And yet, he was taking on that responsibility, right, to continue. You know, why is it that a student can enter into training, put on the robe of a practitioner, do jikai, be ordained, and then turn away from that? We can burn our robe, we can give away all of our Dharma books, we can put our meditation cushion up in the attic, we can never say another word about the Dharma. And then in one moment, a year later, 10 years later, 30 years later, I've seen it happen frequently, in a moment of tragedy or meeting death or crisis or just remembering, that person turns to the Dharma and it's there, in full. It's never gone anywhere. How can that be? This Dharma has no mind, no intention, no plan for you. It's not working on your behalf. It's not creating obstructions for you. It has no hopes and dreams, no disappointments. As Dada Roshi used to often say, it is not like anything. And when we think of karma as itself impartial action. The action itself, the intention is not impartial, but the action abides in its own Dharma state. It is not justice, it is not mercy, it is not punishment. We can experience it that way, we can add that meaning to it, but it in and of itself knows none of those things. It is simply how things work in the human world. One action is one action. How it's felt, how it's perceived, how we respond to it is a result of our karma, That's what we study. That's why it's so important to, in cultivating our meditation, that we're seeing not just what arises, but how do I respond to this? That's the essential thing. Because in that is all of my history. It's my beliefs. It's my views. It's my faith. What am I placing faith in that moment that I react? What am I trusting? What is my desire? And because all of that has been so inculcated, so integrated within us, we don't see all of those aspects. That's what we're practicing to do. So that becomes more and more clear. Right? That's how it is that we can be in the same room where the same thing is happening and have very different experiences of it. Dogen said, the way in the Mountains and Rivers Sutra, said, the way of seeing mountains and rivers differs according to the type of being that sees them. There are beings who see what we call water, they see as a jeweled necklace. This doesn't mean, though, that they see a jeweled necklace as water. How then do they see what they consider water? Their jeweled necklace is what we see as water. Or, again, they see water as miraculous flowers, but it doesn't follow that they use flowers as water. Hungry ghosts see water as raging flames or as pus and blood. Dragons and fish see it as a palace or a tower or as the seven treasures of the Mani Gem. Others see water as woods, walls, or as the Dharma nature of immaculate liberation, or as the true human body, or as the physical form and mental nature. Humans see these as water. And these different ways of seeing are the conditions under which water is killed or given life. There is no fixed perception. There is no absolute objective reality. We experience things through our mind as mind, which is why it's so important to allow our minds to regain their natural clarity, to let them become unbiased, so that we can see things as they are. Because in our seeing things, particularly with all of our karmic entanglements, we kill and we give life. And sometimes we kill by destroying, and we give life by accumulating and attaching. But there's also killing by seeing into the real nature of things, realizing their emptiness and no longer being caught and tethered, and then giving life by now actualizing that in the world. And so what we see and experience and what we call it and how we understand it are based on the conditions under which we have that experience, that moment. And so Dogen says, thus what different types of beings see is different. And we should reflect on this fact. Is it that there are different ways of seeing one object? Or is it that we have mistaken various images for one object? Do things just exist on their own, have their own objective reality? And they're just different beings, different ways of seeing that one thing that exists in its own absolute state? Or have we mistaken various images for an object? Is every perception in every moment by every being bringing in their particular world and projecting it onto that object? And so in practice, we are witnessing that mind, memories, likes and dislikes, beliefs, ideas, and seeing, beginning to see how that projection takes place. I mean, just think about how you look upon something in one moment, or at one day, on one day, or at one time of your life, or in one mental state, and then how you look at it at a different time, in a different mental state. I was thinking about, I remember years ago I went on a long backpacking trip by myself in which I was doing a lot of bushwhacking and kind of pushing the edges of my knowledge and my capacity. And so, you know, there were some slightly harrowing experiences that I had. But I remember when I left and I was going up into the woods and I could hear the sound of the cars behind me on the highway. And it was like, to get away from that, to get away from that. It's like those sounds were, you know, wrong. And, you know, like I wanted to get away from them, right, into the quiet of the woods. And then I remember after coming back and hiking in the woods for so long and having these different experiences, and the first moment when I heard the sound of the cars, and it was like, oh, that's so good. It felt so good. And even in that moment, I was thinking, wow, okay. So Dogen says we should concentrate every effort on understanding this very question, and then concentrate still more. Given the multitude of perspectives, it follows that the training on the way of practice and verification must not be merely of one or two kinds, and the ultimate realm must also have 1,000 types and 10,000 kinds. And that can sound a little intimidating or overwhelming, but he's really just talking about in each moment, awake. Because in every moment, there is a new, freshly made world that appears. And to think about this, what Dogen is saying, what he's realizing, what all of these Dharma teachers, and really every spiritual practitioner who has entered into and seen deeply on their own, you know, within their own tradition, and to the extent that they might, the relationship between the person and the mind and the changeability of that, the fickleness of that, and the world, and the relationship between what we do and what happens, and the immense importance of examining that, right? Because given the multitude of perspectives and all the ways, and so is it that there's one absolute truth? Which means some people are seeing it correctly and some people are seeing it incorrectly. Well, does that just mean that everything is relative and it's just whatever you want to see is true? No, not from a Buddhist perspective. There is right and wrong. There is causing harm and there is bringing benefit. That's real. And we should know the difference. And we are learning to recognize the difference in moments and situations where it may not be clear. And then to think about the time that we're in where that kind of examination is not happening on a grand scale. On a grand scale. And that that is being codified, institutionalized. And that actually examining things, being open to the possibility of different perspectives, is considered sacrilegious, is held in contempt, is held as dangerous, is held as a deception. That does not bode well. That path does not bode well for us. And we can understand why having a cherished view, even within Dharma practice, when we fall in love with the Dharma, you know, sometimes the students who have the most trouble when they go to a different tradition, a Dharma tradition, Buddhist tradition, or a different center, even within their own tradition, sometimes they have the hardest time actually being a student because they've learned the right way to do it. And so that's why one of the virtues that we're cultivating is pliancy, flexibility of mind. At the same time that we are exerting this Dharma to the fullest, right, and trying to really understand what is true, not in some absolute objective sense, but in the sense of this human life and the ways in which our lives interact with the world and the earth and all of the many creatures. And when we see that pain and suffering is being created, that's telling us something is not working here because that doesn't exist on its own. And when we see that things are moving in a different way, that's telling us something is working here. And to recognize that at the level of the interior, the Buddha realized, is actually essential. If we really want to be good instruments in this world, to actually bring benefit into this world in whatever ways we can, we have to study this multitude of perspectives within ourselves. You know, I was just saying to somebody earlier this morning, you know, when you study your mind, that's the template for the whole of humanity, right? You're studying the basic stuff of all of humanity, right? Because mind is mind. And we all share the same body. That's what the Vasettasutta, the Buddha, made so clear. We appear in minorly different ways that we often make way, way too much of, in ways that have created so much pain. And all along, there is a treasury of the eye of truth within us. Is us. Where is that truth? And so teachers have said, give up searching for it outside. And don't look for something inside. Just relax your mind. Bring it into a clear, sharp, penetrating focus. In the poem, he says, the robe of faith imparted at midnight to Hui Nong, stirring up the 700 monk monastics at Huang Mei, talking about the controversy that arose where Hui Nong, this illiterate, supposedly illiterate and lay, non-monastic, received the transmission. Here, he's referring to Lin Ji, the blind ass destroying the true eye, gets the hatred of others. I don't know whether, you know, he seems to be suggesting that the students there reacted badly to what San Cheng and Lin Ji were saying. But then in the poem, Hong Zhu says, mind to mind, they seal each other. Lin Ji and San Cheng, they seal each other. They knew each other. They understood. That when San Cheng said, how dare I destroy the teacher's treasure? He was saying, I will not disappoint you because I will not disappoint myself. Lin Ji once said to the assembly, he asked the question, what is the source of your struggle, looking out at the assembly? And he said, the source of your struggle lies in the fact that you don't yet have full faith in yourself. If you don't have faith in yourself, then it will be hard not to hurry around trying to keep up with everything and everyone around you. You'll get turned around by whatever environment you find yourself in, and it will be hard to move freely. But if you can just relax this mind that goes rushing around from moment to moment and place for place looking for something, then you will be no different from the ancestors and the Buddhas. Do you want to get to know them, these ancestors and Buddhas? Do you want to get to know them? They're none other than you. You, these people, sitting before me, listening to this teisho. And so Hong Zhu says, in the end, the method is knowing how to fly. It's just that, knowing how to fly. Which means, and the footnote to that says, the treasury of the eye of truth still abides. Yes, it does. And here we are. How do we learn this method of knowing how to fly? There can only be one way. Flying.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.org.